Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
That was the voice also of Brian Brown, Brown Briefly. It was the voice of Brown Briefly. And this is Michael Shook, your host of the Briefly Today. With me in the studio this morning is our usual assemblage of carousing commentators, indefatigable insurgents, and just plain interesting folks. Directly across from me is the Flying Cowboy, retired airline pilot, current small plane pilot, and our soundboard slinger, Texas Truman O'Brien.
This is better. Yeah, I like the soundboard slinger. Yeah. That's good. That's good. Thanks.
And he does a fabulous job of it.
Right.
To the left of Truman is just an empty space. Bruce Hallman is still drumming lessons into the heads of his pupils down under, and his chair was reported seen in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. Thus, we move left again to the
easy for you to say.
How many pickle peepers? To the swashbuckling sailor and political seer. I gotta knock this off.
Holy smokes.
Indivisible Vachon's own Kevin Jones.
Good morning.
To Kevin's port side, that's left again for landlubbers, is the Dixie Darling, member of the string band Listen in the Kitchen, not to be mistaken for the KBs. Lynn Kerrigan.
The KBs?
That was a phrase my mother used to
What does that use. Mean?
I'm not sure if I can say that on the radio.
Well, wait a minute. You wanted my introduction.
It was usually in response to me saying something about dishes or the kitchen or something, and she'd say, what, do I look like one of the KBs?
Oh, so I've
kitchen.
Female dog.
She didn't have a lot to do with...
Let's get that right out of my intro.
That's right, because I was thinking killer bees. That was just
yeah,
not
killer,
it either,
I'm right? With you, yeah, right.
But I said not to be mistaken.
Exactly right, so we know we're not the killer bees.
To Lynn's left, we have Thespian, whole Vachon coordinator, co-coordinator, and the former KVSH head honcho, who is the current host of Real Talk, Susan McCabe.
Good morning,
good morning,
everyone.
And we have a special guest today.
Are you live today, though?
Is she is live.
Can you tell us who you have?
I am live today, and I am happy to have with me Karen Dhaliwal, who is going to talk to us about the unguarded art auction that happens in Tacoma this weekend.
Oh.
Art created by incarcerated people.
Ooh.
Who are remarkable artists and donate all their proceeds to, I think this year it's a YMCA programs.
Wow.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's
very interesting.
That's
cool.
It sounds like a fabulous,
a
very interesting story. Yeah. And what a worthy thing. I mean, there again, art can bring things out and give them soil to live in.
Art saves lives and connects people, and that is what this show is all about.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. That's great. As I was saying, a special guest today, Briefly Emeritus, Peripatetic Poet, Island Hopping Novelist, Gail Kellner.
Good morning, everyone.
Howdy.
So happy to be here.
Yeah, welcome back.
It's been
here
a little while.
And congratulations on hearing about your book. I know we'll hear more about that later.
But yeah,
congratulations.
Thank you.
It is Tuesday, February 11th, in the year of the tweeting twit.
Well...
And things just get more and more strange. There is a plague of locusts in Africa, a growing plague in the coronavirus, there are the explosive fires in Australia, and in Florida, we have Matthew Lusk, a Republican running unopposed for a congressional seat, unopposed for a national congressional seat. Mr. Lusk, according to the New York Times, openly embraces the internet political conspiracy blog QAnon. No one knows who Q is or what Q is. While Lusk is uncertain whether there really is a pedophile ring associated with the deep state, this is a slander commonly circulated by Q, he does, quote, believe there is a group in Brussels, Belgium that eats aborted babies. I just, every time I read that, I just, it just kind of knocks me back that
this guy believes it.
He believes, he sincerely believes it, and he's running on a post, which means this person will be in the National Congress in after 2020
House of Representatives.
Right? Lord.
Oh boy.
Also in Florida, at a Trump rally, supporters dropped by a tent where they were informed by Q devotees that Democrats were secretly torturing and killing children to extract a life-extending chemical from their blood. Why not? We revived torture during the W. Bush years. Why not bring back the ancient blood libel of Jews, only this time directed at Democrats?
Didn't they lift that directly from
the
little
planet
dark
gone
crystal?
Mad?
What? Do that again.
Has the planet gone mad?
I think we have evidence that it is.
Yes.
It's
the planet
just,
is speaking.
This something is speaking. And I know these are fringe groups, but boy, it's really interesting as the pressure grows on cultures and societies to try to deal with all the problems that are coming up. It really seems like people start, you know, folks on the outer edge of the orbit there start to really spin off into crazy stuff. And it's kind of funny in a macabre way, but it's also pretty unsettling because these people take it really seriously.
I think that it's also, though, important to remember that there are so many more people who are working for a better world that are good, kind people helping their neighbors, helping their communities, and that in fact, in some ways, as things get worse, they get better. That it is fuel for change and positive change. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's easy to lose sight of in the craziness that's out there.
That's so true. The craziness of the news cycles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think it's important to remember that the news cycle is fueled by anything sensational, anything that will inflame people.
I've just contributed to it.
To purchase things. What?
I've just contributed to it. Oh,
that's
no.
Right.
Yes, you did. Well, I would also like to say that since Mr. Lusk is going to be elected, someone has to represent the crazy people.
I do have to say that I did a lot of phone calling into places like Florida in 2016. And some phone calls you never forget. And this was a gentleman who was clearly did not want Donald Trump to be president. He really didn't want Donald Trump to be president. And so I said, oh, awesome. So you're going to be voting for Hillary then? No, I don't think so. And it's like, tell me your logic here. And it's like, no, it's just all karma. It's whatever's going to happen. It's just karma. Mm-hmm. So I don't need to be part of it. It's just karma. And so, you know, there are some people, well, I don't know, crazy might not apply, but.
Mm-hmm. Sort of fatalistic about it.
I don't know, fatalistic in a sort of karmish way.
Karmish?
a new word coined on the briefly. I like it.
My karma ran over my dogma.
Exactly.
I can only wish.
One of the things that strikes me regularly is the majority of voters in the United States who did not vote, who do not vote. 35% of registered voters on a regular basis vote in presidential elections. Afghanistan gets 35% of voters out when they're under fire. Mm-hmm. What's wrong with those people?
Well, you know, did you watch the, what was the name of the little town in New Hampshire that voted at midnight?
Oh, something Notch.
Yeah,
Dixon's
one of them.
Notch or something.
Yeah, one of those. They had some folks who, I mean, all of them were required to either vote or say they're not going to vote. And there were several who said, no, we're not going to vote. I mean, they let folks know officially that they weren't voting.
Mm-hmm. And what was the reason that they gave?
I have no idea. But there was a category for we're not going to vote.
What I've tended to hear is that people want somebody to represent them exactly versus being pragmatic about the field and sort of the bigger questions, you know. So what I'm concerned about is the percentage of Bernie supporters who say they will not vote for
a different candidate than Bernie. To me, that is not only selfish, but it is completely unpragmatic and will help lose an election. To me, we have a constitutional duty to turn out and vote, and we take for granted our privileges here. We're losing them rapidly.
You're
absolutely right, Lynn, and that tells me how little we educate people about democracy. We're losing our democracy because people take it for granted, and they don't understand their role.
Gail, you're a teacher. They're not teaching civics in high school anymore. I mean, what's the deal?
Well, I've heard people say that, and I would have to honestly really go and look at what the state standards are around that. But I have actually never been in a school myself that doesn't deal with these issues. Civics, as we knew them, growing, most of us are over 50. some of us by a little more than others, but the at that time, it was a class and it was identified as such. Now it is often integrated into many other studies. And so I can say as a teacher, I did teach what we would call civics, even at fourth and fifth grade levels. And I have never been a school that doesn't have some form of that.
Okay.
This is good stuff. And it kind of goes to the heart of some of the things that David Brooks, the syndicated columnist for the New York Times, brought up, and he was talking about values and different issues and how those are connected in his latest column. And he mentions where in 1960, John Kennedy ran on the missile gap. Well, we know now that, of course, the CIA inflated all those figures, so there was actually no missile gap except on the Soviet side. But Richard Nixon ran on law and order in 68. And in 2016, he says Trump ran on middle America identity politics. I would throw in also that Ronald Reagan ran on a positive vision of it's morning again in America, that kind of thing. Obama ran with, yes, we can. We can do this. Franklin Roosevelt and his famous speech about the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. I mean, there... intrinsic to all of those things, I think, is the sense that we have not just the good stuff of democracy to enjoy, the good stuff of a functioning society, but we have a really deep responsibility, our ability to respond to the needs of our culture, of our communities. And that seems to me something that is, I don't know, I don't want to say it's missing, but what's going on there?
Can I bring up Nicholas Kristof's wonderful column that was in this morning's paper? He was talking about there are two Americas, and that Trump in particular is playing to one America, the wealthier people, people who have lots of money in the stock market, people who are employers, job, quote, creators. And there's a whole different side of America of people who are not being talked to, not being assisted. In fact, Trump is now after our safety net programs, despite the fact that he said he would not do that. And I think that, as long as somebody gets away with pretending that America is only the people that support him, that is not an acceptable kind of state of affairs for me. We need a president who will look after both sides of our coin.
It's intriguing, the comment made earlier, Michael, about stoking this news cycle of crazy people who are running for Congress. I saw some interesting data a little while ago about views of the role of government, and particularly women who view the role of government as really essential services that are supportive, necessary, and women have, of course, a perspective of having children and taking care of children and job market and child care and, of course, health care and all of those things. And I just, when I hear about the QAnon and all that, I just see the statistics on the suburban housewife vote of, you know, they're getting less and less enamored with what we have and more and more hopeful for what we could have, right? Mm-hmm. Which is so much better, and the conspiracy theorists can go back to the fringes. So I hope that's the reaction that we
see.
Back
into the closets, back into their basements.
Mm-hmm. But it does take, I think, Gail, what you're saying, you see sort of, there's this yin and yang of, you know, we seek this better world. And if we see a world that doesn't really create the values or satisfy what we need to seek out something better. Mm-hmm. And I think these are the examples of what motivates us to find something better.
Mm-hmm. And I do believe that as women in the coming years move more and more into positions of power, I think we will see a trending towards taking care of community. It is something innate in women to care for children and to see it from a slightly different viewpoint than men may see it. And I think there are many men that come to the same conclusion, especially as they age, that the importance of caring for our the larger community.
Mm-hmm. I think certainly that's true. Women are the ones who are sitting with the kids in the doctor's office, or trying to find the child care.
I always think, well, if we had a council of grandmothers in charge, how can you imagine any of them choosing to bomb a village? Only under extraordinary circumstances and only to save lives. So that makes me think, there's hope in the there's still I still held out hope the grandmas.
I would love to see a council like that, and I think it's important that it be elders, grandparents like that.
I was just going to say, you obviously don't know some of the grandmothers I know.
Well, I had.
Yes, maybe so.
But I had, as I said last week, I had a number of grandmothers, and they had their faults for sure. Yeah.
No, truly, I agree. But I have known some.
Sure.
There are always exceptions. Yeah. And there are always exceptions.
I mean, Phyllis Schlafly practically single-handedly stopped the ERA. And last I looked, she was a woman. So it's not always. Women don't march in lockstep any more than men do.
No, exactly.
You see, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was cited in an article, I think today or yesterday, that suggested that rather than try to resurrect the legally dead Equal Rights Amendment, that we start over.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That there is a new movement toward codifying the fact that women's roles and women's thoughts are important, and that, you know, we don't need to be discriminated against in jobs or in benefits or anything like that. So, you know, I listen to Ruth Bader Ginsburg when she speaks. It'll be interesting to see if that mantle is taken.
She could
up.
Be on the grandmother's council there. And, yeah.
She could be the grandmother. And this whole ERA thing raises my hackles and speaks to me of the misogyny that is so deeply ingrained in our culture, and even held by women.
Yes.
I think capitalism might be the distinguishing factor beyond gender, but I'd love to see the ERA started all over again from scratch. I'm hoping it would pass.
Well, and I think that there's a lot of merit in that idea, only because if you look at the changing of American attitudes towards the LGBTQ community, and it was like sort of a startlingly fast transition. But what it was the fact that we have different systems now, right, that allow people to express views on social media, which is now more prevalent than when the ERA was first started. So in other words, you can have a landslide of changing public opinion. And when people tell their stories and people sort of resonate with the fact that this really is unfair, we need to do something about this. And so perhaps that's the way, another surge,
and
another
that's,
wave.
Absolutely. It is important to remember, though, that the whole idea, people say, well, that happened so fast. And it makes me think of the band that I saw on the Grammys one night saying, I'd like to thank all our fans for supporting us all the years we were busy becoming an overnight success. The years of touring on the road and everything. And that's what, it's easy to forget that Stonewall happened in 72, I believe. Mm-hmm. And for, so one to that, that was over 30 years, 40 years of grinding it out, of people going to do what needed to be done to state legislatures and so on to get equal rights, equal access.
I was just going to say that, you know, to kind of link this back to the previous conversation, is that to me the question of uber capitalism, which is sort of maybe been, let's use the metaphor of testosterone fueled, if not literally testosterone fueled, versus the idea of social democracy, which I guess is hard for people to understand. It's not quite socialism about, you know, the countries nationalizing the oil distributors, that kind of thing. It is the idea that under capitalism, there will always be winners and losers, if you will.
Sure.
People that fall to the casualties of a very competitive system. And so, you know, Roosevelt kind of really was, to me, the epitome of the social democracy, which is about sort of spreading the wealth in a different way to make sure that the vulnerable people get enough services to not starve to death on the streets during depressions.
To act as a... For example, as we hear every week in church, to feed the hungry, clothe the naked, and house the homeless.
Exactly. And so it's a kinder system than to confuse our economy with a system of government. And that's what we've done.
We've conflated. Mm-hmm. I think we've conflated that. And, and capitalism is a great system, but it's got to have regulations on it, or it does what it's doing now.
Well, and it's just plain good business to support our citizens. If people are poor and homeless, they're not working, they're not paying taxes, and they become desperate, and then the crime rates go up. I mean, it's if you're not thinking in a charitable way, then think in sensible economic way
which
we support our citizens. Government is here to provide services for our citizens, and capitalism is about power and domination.
It's about money and nothing but money.
Exactly. Everything has an economic value, and what does not have an economic value has no value in that religion of capitalism,
which is why it's so important to keep it separate and regulate it.
I guess it would help if I turned my mic on.
Oh, we can hear you so much better now.
Sorry, you guys can hear me quite well, couldn't you? As I was saying, I was in the airline industry for a very long time, and I was involved when the deregulation happened. And I can tell you that the benefits of deregulation from the airline industry were many. You had much cheaper fares. You had higher, stronger competition. You had routes that were available that were not available when it was regulated. So, you know, I'm kind of, I'm not sure that,
Don't bring up the question of balance, Truman, because it's not either or, in my opinion. It is a matter of how a good democracy can balance the two for progress for everyone.
And the other thing I was thinking about was, I don't know how many of you had anything to do with banking during the Obama administration, but I can tell you that, man, I mean, I know people that could not get a loan that because they were lower income, but they could not get a loan because the banking regulation was so stringent that they were locked out. And this was supposed to be helping, these folks.
Well, I do believe that at that point it was in response to, the overage, all the subprime lending.
It was,
crisis.
Obviously. It's the pendulum swinging, and it swung way too far to the wrong direction, I think. I mean... So there's got to be some middle ground in there.
It's hard governing ourselves.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's a challenge. I know Truman and other people I know were really suffering, right, to try in during that time to try to get loans. And then I think what we don't know is whether that was actually just part of the curative process of restoring the economy. Right. And was that a benefit or not? It's hard for me to measure that. Yeah. But clearly people felt the effects of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, I know I was involved. I had to open a bank account after my brother died. I was involved in all that. And man, I practically had to give blood to open a bank account. I mean, it was amazing.
Right.
It was like, come on.
Because is it not so that the banks had violated so many of their own regulations and risking all of the funds in America to do so without it, without being kind of regulated. Then when the regulations came down, it really tightened the belt for everybody, and they had to find some balance.
Got to be
that
middle ground. Yeah. I think there's a middle ground. That's all.
I might say just a personal observation, and I suspect everyone here has had this experience. You know, you now go to buy a ticket on an airplane, and after you buy your ticket, then you're asked, "Would you like to buy a seat?" It is not. Last time I think I got a cracker thrown at me.
Yeah,
and a little water.
If you were lucky.
Yeah. You know, the experience of flying. You know, charges for baggage, charges if you know left every, you know, change make any kind of small change. You know, I ended up with recently, you know, just like $1,000 expenditure for two tickets, and supposedly one of those was the, you know, that the free ticket that you get get with it, and so I'm not sure that complete this deregulation of the airlines from a passenger's experience has been that much better.
Except that, I will say that having experienced from the other side both of those, you can, if you look at the passengers as they get on and off the airplane, it used to be folks kind of dressed up, you know, and it was really nice, and now it's like Greyhound, you know. I mean, you would not believe some of the people coming off those airplanes, but they're hauling a heck of a lot of people.
And that's, there's the sort of expectations and what we came to expect when the sort of the golden age of jet travel for most Americans was sometime in the 60s and early 70s when fuel prices were really low. And it didn't matter. You know, you look at those ads from 1966 or something, and there's these huge, they look like Lazy Boy recliners in the plane. You know, there's four people across. You know? But I think that's kind of a false time for us. I look back on my parents and the generations before that, people never traveled. We're so used to that we feel like, well, it's almost like a right. Yeah. I have the right to travel.
Yeah.
If I want to fly somewhere, why shouldn't I? Well, there's a price to pay for that.
I think of the when Reagan fired all of the air traffic controllers for striking, that, you know, there has to be some regulation of these things. You know what I mean, there's, you got to have some rules, obviously, for it to work. I think it's the economic strangling or control that's the issue.
Squeeze it down too much, but I think what we're seeing now, just my opinion on the tickets and airlines and how many are crammed in there and everything, pretty soon I expect to see folks, you know, holding on to the loop like on a subway or something.
Exactly. We've said that a lot.
But
won't be surprised.
In order for them to make it pay.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm
telling you, it's starting to swing the other way because there is an incredible pilot shortage right now, and so all of the rules around pilots have been really they have been strengthened because of a number of accidents because of the deregulation. So those rules are strengthening, and now the economics are driving it such that there's going to be a lot more regulation. And anyway, it's coming back the other way, guys.
Yeah, but Michael, I'm thinking about what you said. It's like, this brings to mind, how many people can you fit in those overhead storage lockers?
You know, if a child six or under. Be quiet, Billy. Just
don't wiggle too much.
That's right. As we look ahead at climate crisis, airplanes are causing a huge amount of the carbon emissions in the air, and hopefully
the world will start to regulate that. And that's probably going to make air travel cost more. But okay, I'm okay with that.
I just saw an article this morning on one of my aviation blog things that Airbus is now looking at a blended body airplane, which will be about 20% more fuel efficient. It's the whole body of the airplane lifts. You know, anyway, that's going to be the new thing.
And they are coming out with some new fuels that are, potentially less, quite a bit less impact with regard to greenhouse gases that can be used even in jet fuel.
Sorry, I didn't mean to get us off on this airline.
It's all tied in there with people's expectations of what is a good life and how can I live.
And that to me is a perfect segue to Gail, who is visiting us and is launching her new book.
Yes.
Hope, the History of the Future.
Yes.
And I hope you'll tell us a little bit more about that.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Lynn. Well, I've been working about 3.5-4 years now, nearly, on a book that I wrote in part in response to my students. I was formerly a teacher, and I just saw this. I saw my students as well as my own adult grown children growing very despondent and quite hopeless as they looked forward at the future. And this was not just teenage angst. This was just, these were, kids that were only 11, 12 years old, but they were exposed, like all children are in almost all families, to the news as it comes in through the car radio, through little bits of information, on the television or the computer, their parents' conversations. And so I set out with the idea, holding myself to scientific possibility as well. I set out to write a book of hope, like, okay, what if we did it right? And the working title of the book was called A Perfect World, a History of the Future. And it turned out what it is it's a story that's written takes place 7 generations in the future. And it looks back and we have by that time have obtained peace, justice, and verdant sustainability. The book is supported by historical and legal precedents. And in fact, the back of the book is filled with 5 different historical documents that I've been wrangling with the publisher because they're like, oh, you could cut this out and that'll be, it'll be fine. People can look it up on the internet. I'm like, nope, that's really important to me.
That's a great approach, I think.
Yeah.
Seriously, to ground it like that.
Yes.
That's great.
Yeah. So besides the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights, the other legal documents that are in print in the back of the book are the 1928 Treaty for the Renunciation of War, a little known document signed by most of the world powers shortly after women got the vote. They turned their attention towards peace, and that was a major push of the women's movement that people are unaware of. And
unknown.
And I include that. I also include the UN Declaration of Human Rights, developed in 1948. Eleanor Roosevelt had a large part of that as well, of course, as her husband. But she was a big push in that. That document is also included in the back, as well as a 2018 Parliament of the World Religions 5th Directive, which is the Parliament of the World's Religion is a groups of there's some 80 representatives plus around the world, all major religions, as well as indigenous cultures, and some that when I went to the parliament in Toronto in 2008, they are it's a worldwide religious organization, and it is also working towards justice, peace, and sustainability. And the 5th directive, which was passed in 2018, is a commitment to putting sustainability and taking care of the earth as a religious responsibility. And so what I did was I using this historical base and and I, again, basing it in scientific possibility, it does take, the book takes us through what happens after a collapse of society as we know it. What could be rebuilt based on what we've, you know, things that have, that based on these historical precedents and legal precedents, which is important in our world in many ways. And then it, it also asks the question, you know, do we have to go through a collapse? Could we make that transition sooner? And that in book two actually will deal a lot with the science behind moving forward.
No, wait, book two.
Yeah, I've, I well, there, it's a series. It turns out saving the world takes a little time.
So this is great though. But you've already got the seeds for that. Yeah, that seed, second part.
Yeah, book two is coming, and yeah. So and it it will deal quite a lot with more of the technological advances as well that would in coupled with historical documents.
So is this told through the eyes of? Do we have some protagonists and?
As it turns out, there are. There are over a dozen characters as it's, the story is told.
And, well, the seven generations.
And, exactly. And so, and the story is told through three families who live through the, through these times. Mm-hmm. So, and each one has is seeing different pieces of it. And
oh, that's great.
So it's a, without giving away too much, there's a history book that falls out of the future. Into the library, onto the library floor of this, into a, this family's house, and then each member of the family finds the book that has a kind of, it has a little magic in it, in that it, it has, it moves and opens its opens and turns to particular pages. There's a cat involved as a coyote character, and so it's a story. It's a fun, it's a romp to read.
Yeah. It has elements of mythology in there.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. So,
And how might one get this book, Gail?
Okay, well, it's coming out. Greenleaf Book Group has picked it up. They're a publisher out of Austin, Texas, and I'm in contract negotiations with them now. As soon as that is settled, then it'll be four to six months until it's published, and it will be, it'll be available in our local bookstore. I'll come down and do a author's talk. It'll be a, you know, from Barnes and Noble to Amazon. It has an international component for their marketing, so hopefully we'll get it out that way. And yeah, so
once again the title,
it's called Hope: A History of the Future.
I love that title.
By Gail Kellner.
And you will appear on Real Talk.
Yes, I will.
And it
I
is.
Would love it's to. A,
I feel would. Better already. I mean, seriously, I'm like, wow, this is cool.
Well, it's been, I think it's timely and a topic. And whenever I put it out on like Instagram or the internet and just said, okay, see what happens if I put this title in the, and the picture is of a girl, boy, kind of androgynous in the background holding the world in their hands. And, and then it has the title Hope: A History of the Future, and it just goes wild. I mean, 12,000 likes will come across my, you know, a phone in a few days. Mm. So it's definitely cool. I think we're ready for it. I think we're ready for the audience.
And you know, Michael, when you said, you know, you feel better already, I think it is critical that we lift ourselves out of this cesspool of despair that that is incited by all of the media and by oppositional kind of politics. You know, it benefits them for us to be paralyzed and despairing and staying at home on the ballot. It requires deeper thinking and an openness to ideas, to be willing to think, oh, maybe there are ways, you know, to pull out of this. And time, like you said, these things take time. I was always taught in social work school in the policy world that you must learn to think in the time of trees, that we as humans expect instant results from everything. And some things take time to grow.
Yeah, I love that. Think in the time of trees. And it does, you know, seven generations is roughly 150 years. And so thinking about thinking, that's, you know, that's the time it takes for an old growth forest to come back and be truly a verdant place. And in this, in the book, that is what, you know, I imagine happens, is that our forests and our oceans recover. Now, that's not to say that we can always It's not Pollyanna by any means. If you get in there, it goes right at it. I chose to tell the truth as I saw it. If we do nothing, what might may happen? Mm-hmm. But I also said, I also pursued the line of thought, what if we do something? What if we do act? And so, yeah, I'm immensely happy to have the book out there in the world. And after I, you know, my expenses, 80% of the proceeds from the book will go to our profits from the book will go back to organizations doing the work around, around these issues.
That's generous.
I think you should include Voice of Vashon in that.
Absolutely. No. There's no question.
Sorry,
about
I just
it.
Had to throw out a pitch. You know,
you're right. VOV needs money to keep going. And as I keep saying, it is among the rare animals of independent, no one owns us community radio, which plays right into the hands of the history of the future in hope.
Uh-huh. And that hope, that hope is the thing that that. It really does lift us from that despair. Mm-hmm. I mean, despair is the enemy of all kinds of things. And as Joan Baez said, action is the antidote to despair. So it's, some impatience is good in there, some desire to work and respond. But messages of hope and inspiration can really be what we need.
One of the things I included in the back of the book is a series of questions, I call them provocative questions, for to sit down with families, friends, in classrooms, and to have discussions about, you know, well, going deeper with regard to what you know, what can we do in our own communities? How can we begin to make that change? Which, can you speak a moment about what's going on with Vashon? How the
whole Vashon
the
project.
Whole Vashon project?
Sure, it is actually starting to mushroom. The idea of the whole Vashon Project is to use Vashon Island as a laboratory for community action in the face of climate crisis. We're working on a catalog, which will be a collection of green goals for 2020 from businesses and nonprofits on the island. In the meantime, we have folks gathering to plan an island-wide Earth Day event or events. We will be communicating those. Mm. We have people coming to us and saying, let's do this, let's do that, let's do this. And that's exactly what we want to happen. To face the, as Rondi, my co-director, says, we're, as a community, facing the climate crisis with creativity and hope. Mm-hmm. That word hope comes up again. And I heard a quote this week from a TED Talk about humor that said, in the dictionary, the definition of laughter is that it is the tangible evidence of hope.
Oh, I love that. I love that.
You know, and I've seen there are other communities I just wanted to share with our listeners as well as you here in the studio. The Lopez Island has started a Fossil Free by 33 campaign, which I was a part of this last year. And that took off so much, both of the other main islands, and now the whole county is looking at going fossil free by 33. And all of that, you know, including like reducing not only our use of fossil fuels, but just materialism in general, the reuse.
That's great.
And being able to support ourselves with our food independence.
We can just, well, humans are astonishing creatures, and we can respond. We can jump in there and do it. And I think I maybe see those harbor lights coming up. Thank you, Gail, for dropping by again.
Thank you,
Gail.
Good to see you guys. Thank you.